Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
About half of oil and gas corporations that operate in this country actually don't pay any tax. And if you add up all the tax that they've paid, you know, in the last 10 years, nurses in this country have paid more tax.
Majority of Australians believe coal, oil and gas corporations should pay for the damage caused by their climate pollution. Also...
The idea about safety and your personal safety is to always remain vigilant. And these moments of being able to hack accounts are opportune moments.
Cybercrime is on the rise in Australia, with more than 87,000 reports made last financial year and later today.
So it's Victory in the Pacific Day here in Australia, and we are commemorating all of those men and women who gave their lives to make this country great. We also have five still living veterans from World War II.
Last Friday, capital cities and regions across the country commemorated Victory Day to remember those who couldn't come back home. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, Australia is still failing to close the gap between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in key health and welfare targets. We've seen improvement in land and water protections, preschool enrolment and employment rates. However, suicide and incarceration rates for First Nations people remain significantly higher than the rest of the country, and too many children are being removed from families in the name of child protection. To learn more, Community Radio Network reporter Noah Seckham spoke with CEO of SNAIC, the national peak body representing First Nations children, Catherine Little.
The only real positive, tangible outcomes were in employment and early childhood education enrolments, but we were also seeing at the same time developmental outcomes worsening. How is this happening? What's missing?
Look, I think it's the ability to implement change and reform at speed and at scale. What you saw in the Productivity Commission report was where governments are making a real concerted effort. And to be clear, you know, there's work going on in all directions, but when that effort is accelerated and it's done in conjunction with organisations and communities, that's when you get real outcomes and you get them a lot faster. When we're looking at things like the statistics that relate to children, we know that in it there are pockets of blue sky. We know that those pockets are all areas where there has been a direct change in a commitment to work better with the Aboriginal community controlled organisations. We know when we're looking at the scale of the amount of change, that is not something communities can do by themselves. And those failings are not the failings of our children. They're not the failings of our families or our communities. They're failings of governments when they continue to fall short on their obligations under the National Agreement on Closing the Gap. Of great concern, obviously, is what we're seeing in child protection. Those numbers are horrific. They are absolutely horrific.
And it feels like we're seeing that play out in the Closing the Gap data as well. Do you think that there's hope for some of these other broader policies that the government's pushing with to get us closer?
Look, SNAIC is really clear in its advocacy, and that is if you want to close the gap, you have to start with children. This is a really easy one. If you're wondering why we come up with that, if you ever sit down and think about what a child needs, it becomes really obvious that a child needs food to eat. It becomes really obvious that a child needs somewhere to sleep. It needs its parents or family members or carers to love them. It needs a nice safe place where, you know, they might be able to go and play or have their own time. They need to be able to go to school. They need clean clothes. They need shoes to put on their feet. And you start mapping out, okay, in order to do that, what does a family need? Well, a family needs jobs. A family needs a house. A family needs to be able to access healthcare. A family needs to be able to access services that a child might need if it's having a hard time or if they're having a hard time. Then you map that out again and you go, okay, well, what then what does the system need? It needed a healthcare service to exist. But the challenge is, how do we leverage it? How do we make it happen? And that starts with working with communities to say, how do we get this up? And how do we make sure we're developing the very best response for you in consultation with you?
We've finally seen the first appointment of the Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander Children's Commissioner. Why has it still taken 18 months to get here? And is it standard practice for these things to take that long?
It took too long, there's no doubt about it. The blue sky on that is that the person that has been given that position is very well respected by the sector, is a fearless advocate for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, and the work that has been going on in the interim period to ensure that that position has the teeth that it will require to be effective. Has been really, really important. If we know that closing the gap starts with our children, if we know that we need to adjust funding models in order to be able to ensure all children have access to services, if we know that there's legislation out there that has been deliberately designed to harm Aboriginal children, then we need to have a look at it. And I'm certainly feeling even more hopeful given that Sue-Ann Hunter, who is our first National Children's Commissioner, will do a fantastic job.
Why is it that there's almost an acceptance that it takes incredible amounts of advocacy and even tragedy for movement to happen in these spaces?
Royal commissions look at legislations, laws, and policies. That's what they do. And then they take 3 or 4 years, and then they make a set of recommendations that the government may or may not implement at its will. As you've said, the Royal Commission into Black deaths and custodies, one of the most incredible royal commissions the country has ever held. And its recommendations were fierce and they were well informed. And some incredible things came out of it. And what the commissioner gives us is a signal that the government is starting to get serious about protecting children. And it gives us great hope that with that position in place, we're going to be able to move things like the national agreement just that little bit faster, because children deserve no less.
Catherine Little from Snake there, speaking with Community Radio Network reporter Noah Seckham. To hear the full interview, you can check out From Pillar to Post wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's national current affairs program.
Majority of Australians believe coal, oil and gas corporations should pay for the damage caused by their climate pollution. Commissioned by the newly formed alliance Make Big Polluters Pay, the polling also found 75% of Australians are in agreement. Climate change and extreme weather are contributing to cost of living pressures. With majority of these big corporations paying little to no tax, the Alliance is calling on government to take action ahead of this week's Economic Reform Roundtable. To hear more, I spoke to Strategic Campaign Lead for Make Big Polluters Pay, Julianne Richards.
A coalition of climate disaster impacted communities, development groups, faith groups, climate groups, youth groups, First Nations and Pacific organisations came together under the Make Big Polluters Pay Alliance, and we polled Australians on their understanding of how fossil fuel corporations are driving the climate crisis and causing costs to us as society. And it was super interesting, the findings, because the overwhelming majority of Australians, 75%, believe that climate change is increasing the cost of living. And the majority of Australians think that fossil fuel corporations, so the big coal, oil and gas corporations, should pay for the damage that their climate pollution is causing, including helping recover from climate disasters and dealing with the cost of living pressures that are being driven by climate change.
And what does the current situation look like for big oil and gas when it comes to contributing to the cost of dealing with climate pollution? And what does that look like in comparison to what an everyday Australian contributes?
Well, the important thing to recall is that these big coal, oil and gas corporations have known for decades that their pollution is the thing driving climate change. So they're responsible for roughly 75% of Australia's climate pollution. And at the same time, despite knowing the fact that they're causing climate change, the vast majority of these corporations have been increasing the amount of coal, gas and oil they extract, the amount of climate pollution they're responsible for. So they're increasing, they're doubling down on the damage that they're causing. And also paying very little tax in this country. So if you look, you know, overall, about half, almost half, coal, oil and gas corporations that operate in this country actually don't pay any tax. And if you add up all the tax that they've paid, you know, in the last 10 years, nurses in this country have paid more tax than all those coal, oil and gas corporations together. So that's not fair. They're making profits that they're sending overseas out of causing climate change, and the rest of us are having to deal with the impacts. So, for instance, after those big 2022 floods that we had, home insurance premiums went up over 10% in 1 year. And the cost of fruit and veg went up as well. So the rest of us are dealing with these rising cost of living impacts that are being driven by the climate disasters being caused by the big fossil fuel corporations, and yet they're profiting from it.
Read the proposition of reconfiguring Australia's economy and tax system in line with these figures. What does this look like in practice?
We're proposing that the government should put in place a levy on these big coal, oil and gas corporations so that they have to pay a climate pollution levy, which would go into a climate compensation fund, which would then be available to those communities dealing with the impacts of climate change. So from cost of living through to communities on the front line of extreme impacts, it would also help workers to transition away from fossil fuel industries to clean industries. It would help First Nations communities who are dealing with climate impacts as well. And we would want to bank some of it for the future so that we put in place resources for future generations, for young people and future generations to be able to deal with the impacts of climate change once we phase out fossil fuels, because those impacts are sadly going to keep growing even after we stop burning fossil fuels.
Realistically, how likely do you think we'll see this kind of action, considering both the opposition and the current government receive significant donations from big oil and gas corporations?
Treasurer Jim Chalmers called the Economic Reform Roundtable, you know, with the support of the Prime Minister, saying that they were open to ideas about how to make our economy more productive, how to make our tax base better. So here's an idea that would make things much fairer. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the Australian budget is in structural deficit. So every year we take on more debt. So we need new, fairer sources of taxation. And here's one that would ensure that the corporations responsible for causing climate change, the big coal, oil and gas corporations, should pay their fair share and help the rest of it.
Julianne Richards from the Make Big Polluters Pay Alliance there, ending that report. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. Cybercrime is on the rise in Australia, with more than 87,000 reports made last financial year, equivalent to one report every 6 minutes. A new campaign launched by the federal government called Act Now, Stay Secure, is urging Australians, especially in regional and remote communities, to take three simple steps to outsmart cybercriminals. The Wire's Azucena Carrasco spoke with cybersecurity expert and campaign ambassador, Jack Reese.
The campaign is about protecting yourself from cybercrime. There's three steps, and they're simple steps. to implement to help safeguard you from cybercrime. One is multi-factor authentication. The second is update your software when devices prompt you. And the third is to use passphrases, strong passphrases, not passwords.
Many people know these tips. Like you said, the strong passphrases, software updates, and multi-factor authentication.
Yes.
But still aren't putting them into practice. Why do you think that?
Well, the practice piece is about habit. We understand the world that we currently live in, and part of that is I guess, being acknowledging and having a level of awareness and understanding that the world is forever changing and rapidly evolving. As I mentioned, the three steps, we all understand what they are. Habitually, as human nature, we just don't seem to implement them. And if it seems difficult, you can Google how to implement these steps. And they are there for all the devices that we use. So whether it's an iPhone, a Samsung, or an iPad or a laptop, you can have each of these three steps set up.
I guess that our number of online accounts and activity online, it is always growing. Managing multiple logins can feel a little bit overwhelming. How can people keep it manageable without compromising security?
Yes. It's a great question. It's a question that comes up quite often. It is, well, how am I supposed to remember 100 passwords for all the different logins that I need? And I'm not denying the difficult nature of juggling multiple passwords at the same time. A lot of devices have their own password wallet, I will call. There are different versions of it. And there is also software out there that provides a password wallet that you can utilize to house your wallet. Now, what I do recommend when it comes to passwords, and I'll change that wording to passphrases, is we're always prompted to update them. And I know it sounds annoying and it is frustrating. However, if you think about the evolving landscape of cyber, there's software out there that can guess passwords at a million times per second. So if you just pause and think and remember that the purpose of changing your passphrases isn't just to be a pain, a thorn in your backside. The reason is for your safety. And the multi-factor authentication as well is that added layer of security. So some of us may have already experienced it. If you are a banking customer and you are wanting to make a transfer on your platform, and when you go to log in, it'll ask for your email and password. And then a second step is, oh, can you please input the code that we've texted to your mobile? That's multi-factor authentication. So although the word may sound like it's something you haven't heard of, it's actually already ingrained in our day-to-day usage. In terms of effort, is the easiest step.
It is a continuous habit that you have to somehow nurture.
Correct. Yes, correct. I mean, the idea about safety and your personal safety is to always remain vigilant. I guess have a level of awareness that, you know, the bad guys are out there, and these moments of being able to hack accounts are opportune moments.
Campaign ambassador Jack Reese there, speaking with The Wire's Azucena Carrasco.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
Last week, The Wire featured the perspective of three Australian veterans for the 80th anniversary of Victory Day, marking the end of World War II. Last Friday, capital cities and regions across the country marked the occasion with a solemn ceremony to remember those who couldn't come back home. The Wire's Rebecca Graham attended the event at Martin Place in Sydney to find out more.
It's been 80 years since the end of World War II in the Pacific. Today, I'm at the Cenotaph in Martin Place in Sydney on Gadigal land for the commemoration of Victory Day, also known as VP Day. On this wet and grey morning, I'm joined by a crowd of veterans, families, dignitaries, and the public who've gathered to pay their respects. Despite the rainy morning, there's a real sense of anticipation in the air. In front of me, there are wreaths which are waiting to be laid. Their fresh flowers adding a burst of colour against the sombre tones of the memorial and grey skies. Among the crowd, there are school groups in uniform. The Australian flag has been raised at the cenotaph, and the mood is solemn. Conversations are hushed and there's a shared stillness as people prepare to honour the moment together. I'm here with Gareth McCrae, who will be the MC for the event today.
G'day. It's a very important day. It is the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. For the, all those years, we lost so many thousands of defence personnel. So many Australians gave their lives to help us enjoy what we have here today. So it's called Victory in the Pacific Day. It's not called VJ or Victory in Japan over Japan Day. That was a term the Americans used. President Truman back in 1945 coined that phrase after the peace was signed. So it's Victory in the Pacific Day here in Australia, and we are commemorating all of those men and women who gave their lives to make this country great. The Prime Minister will be here, the Governor will be here, and lots of other people. And we also have five still living veterans from World War II.
Will this event be a solemn experience?
Well, yes, it is a solemn experience in the sense of so many Australians who died. It's a celebration that the war ended, and that's important, that at last we were able to stop killing each other.
I'm here with veteran Bob MacArthur, who is here for Victory Day today. Bob, what capacity did you serve in World War II?
I was up in the Pacific Islands. That's far enough.
Were you in the military?
Oh, hell yeah, soldier.
When you reflect on today and the sacrifices that everybody made, what can you share with us?
I'm proud to be a bloody Aussie. You can't beat that, mate. You can put that in. Now go home after this and plop into bed and I'll sleep for about 24 hours.
Desley, why are you here today?
I'm actually here with my brother and sister. My father, or our father, and our uncle were in the Second World War.
Chloe, what's your role in the Navy?
I'm a physical training instructor.
And what is your role here today?
Well, my colleagues are doing cat a flag party and such, so yeah, I'm just here just to make sure everyone's all good and everything runs smoothly.
Could you please tell me what the cat a flag party is?
So there'll be four of our colleagues that will be around today's ceremony with just paying the correct respects, and we'll also have two flag bearers as well for today's ceremony.
We now welcome Mr. Harry Alley, who will deliver an acknowledgement of country.
We gather today on land that is sacred. For thousands of years, people have gathered in this place to share stories, to celebrate culture, and to remember our ancestors. Today, we gather here at the cenotaph in Martin Place to honour the cessation of hostilities in the Second World War in 1945, a war that saw nearly 1 million Australians serve. It has been estimated that up to 3,000, perhaps more, were Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander peoples.
And Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
As we stand here today, think of everyone who gathered 80 years ago. Think of the noise of their elation and hanging in the air just beyond the sound of their happiness, the silence of those who never came home.
Solemn and respectful gathering, remembering the nearly 1 million Australians who served in World War II, and especially the 39,000 who did not return. A poignant tribute marking the end of World War II for Australians 80 years on.
The Wire's Rebecca Graham with that story. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.